Welcome once again to Cinemaholics, the Major Motion podcast, where we talk about the biggest and best films coming to theaters and streaming online. From the San Francisco Bay Area, I'm John Agroni, film editor for InBetweenDrafts.com. And from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he's a freelance film writer. And for the past 3 days, apparently we've been missing him and me. It's Will Ashton. Will, I feel a little funny.
I feel like I've been gone longer than that because this show is taking longer and longer to come out now. So it's like,
We're building the anticipation more.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I like that phrasing, though, that we're building anticipation.
I bet the listeners are like, are John and Will possessed by something? Then, yeah.
But no.
We're coming out of this, you know, we're still in the fallout of the strike. We're kind of coming out of this period where the movies aren't being promoted as much, stuff's being delayed, and the release schedule's kind of funky. That's just the truth of it. But we do have kind of an interesting episode this week because we're talking about The Exorcist Believer, which is a sort of reboot sequel of The Exorcist. It's kind of like a Halloween situation where David Gordon Green directed that movie and this one, where he basically took the first movie and was like, well, the sequels never happened, forget they exist. And then it's just doing an updated one, you know, decades later. And it's bringing in characters in the original. It's doing that same old tired whatever thing. And The Exorcist, the original Exorcist was made by William Friedkin 50 years ago. It's considered by many people to be one of the great horror movies, like one of the true greats, right? And William Friedkin, unfortunately, he did pass away earlier this year. And, you know, I think he had a very tremendous career. He had a wonderful life from all accounts. And just in terms of, you know, I didn't know him personally, but just in terms of like, he was still making great films up until the very end. And one of those final films, if not the last one, is a movie called a remake and an adaptation called The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. I always mess up the name of the movie, but it premiered on Showtime. So it's like, it's like a TV movie. It's on Paramount Plus. That's how I watched it. And I mean, it had a couple of promo screenings, I think last month, and here it is, and it's out. And I think, you know, Will, you're the one who came to me and was like, dude, this Exorcist Believer movie. I know, like, at that point when he talked to me about this, like we were planning this episode, Will, you were like, John, you didn't like this movie. I can tell from your passive aggressive text messages. Yeah, you hadn't seen the movie yet. And you're like, are we going to really dishonor William Friedkin's memory this way? So we're actually going to talk about both movies. And I'm really glad we are, Will, because that means we don't have to be in a bad mood this entire time, right?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I was just of the opinion that, especially because this final Friedkin film was coming out for whatever reason, ironically, tragically, fittingly, on the day that the new Exorcist movie was coming out. And I know, like, just based on Friedkin's comments, that he never really approved of any of the sequels, any of the continuations. Like, that's a big one. Yeah. No, but I mean, I think that's one of the big differences between, like, Halloween, the David Gordon Green films, like, John Carpenter, he wasn't really involved with the creative decisions outside of the score, but the film had a seal of approval. I think there was a lot of, like, you know, that it kind of, he gave the movie, those movies, his blessing in a way that this movie just felt kind of like a bastard child that was just like being made behind Friedkin's back. And the fact that it's coming out so shortly after his death, and then now, like, on the day that his last feature comes out, just kind of feels like a slap in the face. So I felt it was only fitting if we did actually see the final Friedkin film, since it would be just as new as The Exorcist Believer. And it was getting good reviews. Like, it premiered at, I believe, Venice or at TIFF. I forget which film festival, but it was getting good reviews. You know, it seemed like it wasn't just people liking the film because it was the last freaking film.
Like,
it
seemed like, yeah.
Yeah. It seemed like people were really genuinely saying,
premiered
at
Venice. Yeah.
Venice. Okay.
Just
yeah, but it seemed like people were like, it's a sturdy, you know, unflashy, well-made film. And I was excited to see it because it had a good cast. You know, it also has, you know, the late Lance Riddick in it, and it's also one of his final films. So, yeah it just seemed like
passed away right before the John Wick movie this year came out. And so this is, I think, the next thing I've seen from him. And I think we can start with Exorcist Believer and then end on a high note. Since we're doing two movies, though, no Rotten Tomatoes game or anything like that for these ones. We might just glance at it real quick, but we do have a show to do. So The Exorcist Believer, we'll start with that. And I think a lot of people listening by this point already know the cat's out of the bag. Critics do not like this movie. It is a movie that is being widely panned. I know that in my screening, like, we had plenty of anecdotes between the two of us, because you didn't go to a screening, but I think you heard some gossip about different screenings that were going on.
Yeah.
Where just to give you a snapshot in time, I mean, there was a lot of hype. You know, there was like a radio station that came out for this promo screening. They did like a trivia thing, and it was kind of fun. You know, it's like a trivia of the first Exorcist movie, and you know, people were really into it. It was a packed house, tons of Exorcist fans. They were getting out T-shirts and posters. The movie ends, we're walking out, and there's a huge stack of posters. Nobody's grabbing them for The Exorcist Believer. I think you told a story of like somebody was trying to give away the thing that they won, the T-shirt or whatever, in the elevator. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Well, I mean, that wasn't my story, but yeah, I saw someone, a fellow critic, was kind of recounting. I heard that. I heard that like one critic found the poster of the movie like in the urinal. I think that was Matt Singer. And that's like the start of his review. Like,
I could see that.
Before he went to his screening, he saw the poster in the urinal. It was like, maybe it was a sign from God that I shouldn't see this film. But I did anyway.
I didn't have the energy to formally review it, just because I was at Austin City Limits this past weekend and it was a long trip. So I was just like, you know what? I'm taking a break. And I didn't want to have to emotionally deal with it, because I really was like bummed out by this movie, just in a lot of ways. And I didn't even have high expectations. And I think Universal and Blumhouse are probably pretty bummed out by the reaction that this movie is getting. Yeah. Now, it's not flopping necessarily, but I don't think it's going to have a long track. It's made $50 million so far worldwide. Only a $30 million budget, which is solid for a horror movie. I mean, those can go either way in terms of their budgets being a little inflated. Sometimes they can be really nice and small. I don't think this one's going to lose Universal a ton of money. I think it will lose it maybe a little bit of money. We'll see. But I think they had high hopes for this. They wanted a whole trilogy. They have a trilogy, I think, just already in the works. This movie isn't standalone in a lot of ways. Like, you could look at this movie, I guess, and be like, it's its own thing. It doesn't need a sequel, I guess. But it leaves so many loose threads that I think it's kind of hard to argue that, in my opinion. But what is it about? So, we do have to mention that they even delayed this movie because of the Taylor Swift documentary. Whoa.
It's not that they delayed it, they pushed it up, because it was going to come out it was supposed to come out Friday the 13th, which makes sense. I think that just kind of added to what was fairly cynical about this movie, is that, like you said, this is the 50th anniversary, it's an October that has a Friday the 13th. It just seemed like kind of similar to, it was Blumhouse that did the Black Christmas remake, right? And they just kind of...
Maybe.
I remember that one they threw together... like less than a year, because they found out that Christmas had a Friday the 13th, and they're like, oh, we can just do a new Black Christmas. That's perfect. And yeah, we saw that
Blumhouse
movie.
Yeah, it was Blumhouse. You're right. You're right.
But I think you forgot to mention that if I read correctly, this is like a $400 million investment to make this new trilogy of films.
I did hear about that, but I don't know where the money is like spent or anything. So it's kind of hard for me to kind of, you know, speak too much. I think the investment came in with the rights, if I'm not mistaken. Just for Universal to be able to make these movies. So in that sense, like, I think that they almost don't have a choice but to like make more of these, but like do it better. I don't know, because this is definitely going to turn a lot of people away, I think, from the idea of more Exorcist movies. But let's just get into it. So David Gordon Green directs, as I alluded to earlier. The guy who made Pineapple Express and then went on to make a bunch of Halloween remakes. Very funny how that turned out. Also, you know, Danny McBride is still part of his creative team with this. He has a story credit. Screenplays by David Gordon Green and Peter Sattler. So yeah, it very much is the Halloween team. I think I've seen a lot of the same names. But the story of this, it's within the canon of the first Exorcist. But again, it ignores the sequels. Personally, I've never even seen the sequels. I never... saw a reason to. Friedkin wrote them off. It's just, they were sequels that came out before we were born. I mean, what was the point, right?
Will say, I mean, you know,
you have a soft spot?
Not that I have a soft spot. I will say, the third one is pretty solid. I think it's worth watching. William Patrick Beatty, I believe, is that his name? The author of the novel?
Sounds right.
The screenwriter of the film. He directed.
Story of his life, by the way, of like how what led to the book.
Yeah, but he directed the third Exodus film. It's worth a watch if you get a chance to check it out. But yeah, the second one and...
William Peter Blatty. You're pretty close.
Oh, okay.
William Peter Blatty, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you got it right. But yeah, The second one, Heretic, and then the Paul Schrader one, and then the one that Warner Brothers made despite the Paul Schrader one. They're fascinating stories, at least like the making of them and whatnot. Yeah. But as films, yeah, I outside of that third one, I don't think you really need to see the other ones to be sure.
Now, the story of this one, again, it's 50 years later, and we are following this. I guess I'll just get right to it. I mean, we have this dad who he's played by Leslie Odom Jr. And there's like this big tragedy that happens with his wife, but his pregnant wife, who, you know, I'll skip the details because it's a whole thing. But basically, he's raising his daughter, and, you know, it's 13 years after this tragedy. And it's kind of hard to explain. It's a little traumatic, honestly. But she goes off, you know, they seem to be having like a well-functioning life, pretty similar to the first Exorcist movie. It's like a single parent home. But, you know, like in that movie, like the mom and the daughter, they got along pretty well. You know, Reagan seemed pretty happy in that movie, if I recall. In this movie, same kind of deal. So the daughter is Angela, played by Lydia Jouett. And I think this might be one of her first film roles. And she goes off on kind of like a little sneaking away out after school into the woods with her friend Catherine, played by Olivia O'Neill. And as they go off into like the woods or whatever, they disappear. No one sees them. And then 3 days later, after they're searching and they're starting to wonder if like they just might be gone and dead, they find both the girls in a very weird place. They have no memory of what happened over the past 3 days. They're covered in like strange marks. Their feet are all messed up, and they start acting very strange. And then very quickly, we're kind of just going through the Exorcist story. They start doing Exorcist things, very similar things to what Reagan went through, but I guess with a few extra flashy things, including like a church scene. There's a mental institution kind of aside that happens. And there's also a lot of like, you know, I think I wrote in my letterbox review for this. It's like, what if the Coexist sticker with all the religious symbols was a movie? This movie is kind of doing that because the original Exorcist is so Catholic. And it's very, in a lot of ways, it's very pro-Catholic. I think in one of the main readings of it, at least with the book. And I think William Friedkin, not necessarily like translating it one-to-one, but leaving a lot of that intact in terms of like just what that movie says about spirituality and all. This movie has a little bit more of just like, it takes a village, you know, like neighbors banding together of different denominations. So we have one thing in common, Will Ashton, God exists. And so that's kind of what we have. I've heard people talk about this of like, it feels like a Marvelization of the Exorcist movies. And that's fueling a lot of like the hatred of this. It's like, people are saying like, fine, sure. By basic horror movie standards, it's not one of the worst movies you're going to see of the year. But it's more so like what it represents, because there are parts of this movie that frustrate me in the sense of like, you know, there's some decent editing here. I feel like the atmosphere is working for me, but not as an Exorcist movie, just sort of as a run of the mill, average, generic horror movie. And that's pretty frustrating. It makes me kind of want to check out Talk to Me finally, which I know I've been teasing, just because I hear that movie is far more in the vein, the spirituality or the spiritual successor to movies like The Exorcist, and not this kind of like bargain basement, like let's make a quick buck kind of franchise looping. But what did you think? Did you love The Exorcist? Are we going to have a fight?
Well, it's funny you mentioned the Marvelization of The Exorcist, because I recently, over the weekend, watched The Pope's Exorcist finally. And that movie is somehow both the Marvelization of the exorcism and somehow a better Exorcist movie than this Exorcist film.
Honestly, if I can cut it, I don't even love the term Marvelization. It feels a little bit too reductive. If there's something that's been Marvelized, and I think that's a very fair comparison, it's Star Wars. Star Wars has been Marvelized.
But I'd say DC as well, but
okay, anyway, The Exorcist. The Exorcist.
Yeah.
The Believer. Are you a believer? Should I play the Imagine Dragons song?
Sure. Please don't play Imagine Dragons. I
should have played that over the trailer.
No, they should have played Smash Mouth's I'm a Believer. I think that would have been a much more fitting song to cut to.
There we go. Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think it's fair to say that my expectations for this film were notably different than yours. I think you went into it, from what I can tell, at least hoping it would be good, or like you didn't know what the reviews were, so you're kind of just like, well, it's, you know, Gordon and company doing the horror thing again, and you know, I think we're softer on Halloween Ends than a lot of people. I don't know if that movie works per se, but I think it's way more interesting than the previous two Halloween films.
Definitely, yeah.
And I know you're soft on Halloween Kills as well, even though I think Halloween Kills is actually worse than this Exorcist movie, but that's neither here nor there. But as far as this movie goes, I think I think it's bad, but I'm kind of two minds in the sense that I think as a David Gordon Green film, it's a little bit better than as an Exorcist film, because like you said, it does have that sense of atmosphere, that sense of suburbia, that paranoia that kind of comes there in. A lot of things that we see, like going back to his earlier films, like, you know, going to like Snow Angels, if you've seen that. I think he can really capture that well. But where I think this movie kind of falls apart is that, unlike the Halloween films, which, you know, take them or leave them, I think they're very clear in their commentary about like mob mentality and paranoia and, you know, like living with the guilt and trauma of, you know, your past and failing to reckon with that and all that. And then like how your environment shapes you. This movie doesn't really, I feel like, have a clear message in what it's trying to say, other than like what you're kind of alluding to is sort of kumbaya, like we can all do it if we, you know, prayer circle together and do it, which makes for a very funny thing where this movie is called The Exorcist, but there's no actual Exorcist. It's kind of like a, like you said, like a hodgepodge.
It's a bit more ragtag, which I don't dislike the idea of like how they try to set that up of like, well, you know, we already did that kind of thing. But then it's a little bit like, well, you should still do something interesting, you know?
But yeah, I mean, I think like when I watch the trailers for this film, I'm like, this just looks like a kind of generic Exorcist movie. It doesn't really look like a film befitting of The Exorcist in terms of like its plotting and tone. And I think that's understandable because when I'm watching a film, I'm like, well, when it's not trying to be The Exorcist, it's not good, but it's at least a little bit more comfortable in its skin, I think. But when it shoehorns in The Exorcist stuff, especially Ellen Burstyn, I feel like it's very, it's hard to like sympathize with it because it is such a direct continuation, and those scenes feel very forced upon, and they don't feel organic to the story. And I feel like the way that this movie handles Ellen Burstyn in particular, without giving anything away, is kind of offensive.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. Like, you're not getting the Jamie Lee Curtis Halloween sort of treatment where it felt like that, at least that first movie, understood and respected what that character meant to the people who watched the movie originally, right? Whereas this movie, I don't know what they were going for. Like, it's genuinely baffling to me, the decisions they made.
Well, John, you're getting the Halloween Kills treatment, which is like when Jamie Lee Curtis was just in the hospital bed for that whole movie.
And then she's miraculously, you know.
But no, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where it just feels inherently cynical that we got this film. Like, I just never got the sense that Green was able to kind of make its own thing, that like he was trying to kind of work around the expectations of the studio, who probably just kind of picked him because, like we said, the Halloween movies, at least the first one, did well. I can't tell if it's just from the jump they didn't really figure it out, or if it got heavily edited down, because there is a scene with Ellen Burstyn and Leslie Odom Jr. where it's like kind of explicitly saying the message of the film, but you could tell it's very heavily ADR'd because they show mostly like Leslie Odom's reactions and like footage of a church. I don't know. It just feels pretty messy in that regard. Like, I just don't really get the sense that it knows what it's trying to do or what it's trying to say. And as a horror film, I don't find it particularly scary because it goes away from what was scary and creepy about the first film, which is that it had the sort of natural, realistic feel, which you think would work for David Gordon Green's strengths. But like, they keep forcing the supernatural or the like, you know, spectacular to the point where I felt like the scenes grew more and more repetitious. And so like the initial draw of something like when the girls come back in the town and like they start becoming possessed, there's something kind of creepy about those scenes. But then when we actually get to the exorcism scene, it just feels kind of monotonous and dull. And we're just like, okay, just get this over with. Their heartbeats are in sync, whatever. I don't know.
I couldn't agree more. I think that like it's even cynical too to just be like, well, this isn't the original Exorcist. Now there's two of them, you know? Also, you mentioned like things that are offensive. Like another super offensive thing is like just the fact that we have a Haitian earthquake, like just kind of treated as this. It reminds me of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they were like, also mass shootings are a thing. So it's okay. Like trying to use these like real life tragedies as a gimmick to try to like make your movie feel like, I guess, contemporary. It's very odd. And that was, I found, pretty deeply offensive. You can tell they filmed it in the DR. It's like there were just like little details where like, that's not Haiti. Like you genuinely like little things that I think like clearly they didn't pay very close attention to in terms of like the culture there. Like, for example, like people in Haiti, like they don't wear shorts. Like that's just a very common thing in Haiti. And it's just like people wearing shorts everywhere. Like it's kind of, it's a little, anyway, that's a small nitpick, I guess. But the things about this movie though, that were promising to me as it was going, to what you're saying, I think that like, when the girls initially, like, they're going through that period of like, okay, the audience knows what's going to happen. The characters don't. And so there is that sort of suspense built in of like, well, how is this going to play out? And I think there was an interesting working of the machinery of the plot where it's like you have the, you know, the more sympathetic Leslie Odom Jr. character and his daughter. And then you have this kind of like, the, you know, white evangelical sort of like, they're pretty, you know, they're positioned and framed as like just genuinely like not great people, right? By the movie and the way that they have their daughter, so it's like, oh, you get to see sort of like maybe S stuff ish hit the fan, you know, with that daughter, and that like they start to build up to that, right? And then there's like this house scene where we were going into that, I was like, this is where the movie starts. Like this could be it. Like this, I think, is going to either save this movie or just confirm that we're done. Like there's nothing. And that's when we get the stuff that I think just kind of, it kind of just ends the movie. It starts off so well, but it just, I wonder if David Gordon Green and these guys, like they clearly understood, I think, elements of what makes Halloween, Halloween. I don't think they truly get what makes Exorcist, Exorcist. I was listening to the folks on Pop Culture Happy Hour talk about this. And like, you know, so I forget who it was, but like somebody mentioned something that I think was really astute about just the way that like our horror movies at this point in time, like the kind of A24, 2014, 2015, like going from like Babadook and It Follows, we had this like wave of like, you know, what people call elevated horror, and just the way that Hollywood has tried to like repurpose that, McDonald's it basically into what we have now, I think has been just like, it's led to where we are. I mean, we're in just a very weird place where I think like these movies are just, I think somebody even blamed it on the fact that like you have Gen Xers making movies like trying to connect with Gen Z audiences. And there's like a gap there. And I think like the argument is that millennials and Gen Z are going to do a better job of capturing what's horrifying, you know, when it comes to the things that the anxieties that people have about what's today. Because when I look at a movie like The Exorcist, this generally does feel like what a Gen Xer is anxious about, which is like a far cry from, I think, what like younger folks are, and older folks too, baby boomers, are scared of. Exorcist was for baby boomers. And like, this is not my Exorcist, Will Ashton. I want my Exorcist.
I mean, I do think you're correct in the sense that there is something very true to the time of the original Exorcist, because we're coming at a point where like Catholicism is more,
we're coming out of JFK assassination, Vietnam is still going on. Yeah.
But there's like a reconfirmation of like faith, and like people are coming a little bit more indoctrined to like Catholicism, I guess, or reintroduced to it. And so,
yeah. Cause also the Manson murders, right. And so like the occult is becoming more of like a scaremongering sort of thing from like the very conservative folks in America. Yeah.
Yeah. And also just like general sense of, I guess, conservative fear over like what like changes are coming about in the '60s and seventies, you know, as opposed to the more straight laced '50s. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think there's stuff that's very true to that, but there is something to The Exorcist that makes it timeless. I think there is just that inherent grounded quality that, Friedkin brought to that film. That like when the head starts spinning and the green vomit comes out and the demonic voice comes, it's more startling because of how grounded and how authentic it felt. That like when that stuff happens, it doesn't feel like jarring. So it's like, oh, I don't believe this. It's jarring. So it's like, oh wow, like this girl is possessed now. It's freaky. Yeah.
Well, he nailed the atmosphere, and I think that's what made the movie so effective in its time. What makes it, I think, also effective to what you're saying today is that it has that antique quality that makes it unsettling for modern viewers. It's not our world, but it can feel like it at times. And there's this sort of, it's like when you see like a kind of haunted seeming photograph from the 1800s, like that kind of like dread that you feel, like it's entering that territory because it came out so long ago that I think it still retains, like it will always kind of retain that quality. I think it's just, it's not that I think it's like timeless in a sense that people watch it today and connect with it with the same anxieties, although they probably can, because I think that there is like a very similar thing that our generation is going through right now that baby boomers were going through in the 70s. Yeah. But just to say, like, I think that like that timeless quality, it's just that it's changed over time in a way that, you know, you can't control, but it's a happy situation for that movie and the people who like it.
Yeah. But I mean, to your point, I don't think it's like I don't get the sense that it's trying to appeal to Gen Z in like a how you do fellow kids sort of way.
You mean this new one, Exorcist Believer?
Yeah. But I do think, I agree with you in the sense that, like, now that Catholicism isn't as, like, commonly practiced, or, like, people don't have that innate fear of God as much anymore, in a general sense, obviously. Like, this movie seems to kind of, like, try to do a lot more in terms of editing and making it, like, you know, like, their faces are even more cut up, and, like, you know, like they're even more, like, their nails are coming out, and, like, their feet have boils, and, like, they feel like they need to go to, like, so many extra lengths to establish this possession that to me it makes it like it pulls me away more. Like the more they do to make that, it pulls me away because I'm just like, oh, it's getting more, like it feels more and more overproduced. Like it feels
it's
more
too
and more
fantastical.
Exact. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I mean by like, it, because they're trying, I don't think it has like a nail down and like what would make me feel anxious in the movie theater. It's not all that extra stuff. Like it's not the fantastical, it's real life. Real life is scary. I just think it's like a fundamental disconnect there. And so I think like the Halloween movies kind of skate by a bit because they're not really trying to do that, but they're just all washed up in the nostalgia legacy of it. And this movie is a little bit more like, well, we don't have to do that because, you know, it's different. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's not a slasher. Like we don't need the same villain. Like, I guess we are. Yeah, we do have the same demon, but we don't have a ton of time. So I want to get to the Kane mutiny. Did you have any final thoughts on it? I feel like I've covered it. I don't like this movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate it, I'll say, but I will say before I forget that, I was reminded from your conversation that, like, I think one thing that's also kind of offensive about this film is it's very sort of haphazard with its race commentary, not only in terms of the opening, the cold open with Haiti, but, like, there's something that's sort of established with the two friends where, like, the parents, I think even the mom at one point says something along the lines of, like, oh, my daughter wouldn't be friends with your daughter if I had known, you know, like, who you were or whatever. And it just seems like it's, like, very sort of out of, that was something that was deeper in the script and it got taken out for a reason, or if that was something that's kind of nestled in there but like never expounded upon. But the fact that it's so impartial to the film makes it feel more offensive because it's just like, well, you can't just like sprinkle that in like Parmesan cheese. Like you have to like either develop something with that or don't. Like it's just very weird to like just make it kind of, you know, partial or whatever.
Before we move on, I do want to shout out, I think Ann Dowd, she really tries in this, and I think probably the best thing about the movie.
I thought the performances were uniformly good. Even like Ellen Burstyn, I think, is doing a good job. Like, I mean, I think her character is poorly written, but
the two girls playing, like the two possessed girls, I think are fantastic. I think that they are giving it their all. They really are great. I wasn't fully on board with Leslie Odom Jr. here. I think at times, like he really brought it. At other times, I don't know, and I don't know if it's the writing or I don't know if it's just the character, the way he was positioned in the story, I didn't always buy it with him. But, you know, it's a lot of other stuff didn't quite work for me in the movie, and that overshadowed any criticisms I think I had there.
I would say, for me, it was the writing with him as well, because, like there's, like, a goofy scene where, like, he gets the Ellen Burstyn book, and he's supposed to, like, just believe it in a matter of seconds, like, all of his doubts, and he just has to, like, you know, like, toss the book to the side and be like, hurrah. All right, I'll read one chapter. Okay, I'll read two chapters. Oh my goodness, my daughter is possessed. You know, it's just like very, like, it's very, very silly and sloppy, but
The movie really loses touch with him or as it goes. All right, well, that's The Exorcist Believer. Don't have time for the Rotten Tomatoes game, but real quick, we'll say it's 23%. I don't know if you would have guessed that, but an audience, even the audience score, I mean, 58%. It's just, It's pretty brutal. I didn't look up the cinema score. I can do that real quick, but I have to assume it's pretty low. It's a C.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's probably in the C territory. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty easy to see why. And let's quickly talk about the Kane Muni court martial. I don't think we'll talk about this as much. I feel like it's just kind of a quick recommend for me.
Sure.
I really like this movie. It's a legal drama. It's just one of those movies, like, it's so small scale, but it's the kind of thing that just moves, you know? So it's based on a play from 1953, but the play itself is also based on a novel that came out the year before called The Kane Mutiny. So to be clear, the novel is called The Kane Mutiny. The play is called The Kane Mutiny Court Martial. There was also a movie, too, but I think this is borrowing more from the play, like how that plays out. Mm-hmm. No pun intended.
And that's, is it Humphrey Bogart in that film?
I don't remember. I don't know. I haven't seen the original.
I haven't either, but I thought
this is my
that.
First like exposure to any of this.
Same here.
So this, as you already mentioned earlier in the show, this premiered at Venice. It's, on Paramount Plus with Showtime right now, if you want to check it out yourself. Cause I think it just played on Showtime in September, if I want to say. It's a quick and dirty movie, 109 minutes, not too long, and the cast is fantastic. So I will quickly walk through the story. It's very simple setup.
I didn't even realize it was 109 minutes. I thought it was like 84 minutes. It moves so fast. Like
it does. It feels 90 or lower. You wouldn't guess it, right? From a movie that only takes place, like, I think we're only in two locations the entire movie. 99% of it is in one location. We'll put it that way. But the whole movie, like, it starts and basically is mostly set within a courtroom. We follow an accused executive officer of a naval ship called the USS Kane. This executive officer is played by Jake Lacy. You might recognize him from like The Office, I think is probably his most famous thing. He's been in other things like Carol, you know, he's like the boyfriend and that.
Yeah. Obvious child, but he's also in the first season of White Lotus.
Oh yeah. You're right. He's the one who's like in a relationship with the Alexander Daddario character on there.
Yeah. The pineapple suite.
Glad you got a kick out of that. So he's being accused of, mutiny on the charges that it wasn't justified. So he committed a mutiny against the captain of the ship. The captain is played by Kiefer Sutherland. The captain is Lieutenant Commander Queeg, who was the acting captain of this ship. He took it over from somebody else. Jake Lacy plays Lieutenant Merrick, who took command away from the captain. And we start the movie, we don't know why, we don't know the context. So we're kind of going into it sort of like the defense counsel. So the way this works is that the judge is made up of a board of military commanders in general, maybe just the Navy. Lance Reddick is the main one. He's like in charge. He's basically the judge of this whole thing. And there's no audience. There's nobody else in the room, but the accused, the defense attorney, even the captain isn't in there the whole time. He gets brought in to be questioned and he leaves. So this movie mainly is the respective lawyers attorneys, we should say. The defense attorney for Jake Lacy is Jason Clark, plays Lieutenant Greenwald, who kind of has an insurmountable job, it seems, because it seems like this is pretty clear cut, because Lieutenant Merrick's case is that he had to take command away. He had to commit this mutiny to protect the ship, and because the Kiefer Sutherland character was insane. And, you know, that's the defense's case, is that he was justified. Yeah. But of course, you know, the prosecution is like, no, you were not justified. Like, there is no indication. There's no evidence. There's no official records that show that there was anything mentally wrong with Kiefer Sutherland. So you kind of have this like movie where they're carting in all these different officers and you're getting an accounting of what happened. There's no flashbacks or anything. It's all in the performance. It's all in the writing, the script, which William Friedkin did do the screenplay as an adaptation, as we said. And you are just sort of watching what happened on this ship through all these different perspectives. And so we're taking from a lot of movies here, you know, we're taking a little bit from like the way that, you know, a sort of like the debate of like how something happened without showing it in something like 12 Angry Men. We're having the sort of like the heat of something like A Few Good Men. And that's sort of like, you know, how am I going to be able to win this case? And within that military context.
Sure.
And you know, borrowing from a movie that came out, you know, before, I think both of those, you know, or a story that was written before those, because I think Few Good Men is 90s,
93.
80s. Yeah. And then, 12 Angry Men, Men is always in the title, huh? Men, 12 Angry Men, I think, is in the 60s, Sidney Lumet. So all that said, great movie. It's really good. And I think the star of this movie for me, really, I mean, there's two of them. I think Jason Clark, you know what? I'll give it to three. Why not? Jason Clark, Kiefer Sutherland, Lance Reddick, come get your roses. I just think that these guys just are electrifying. I really like Monica Raymond, too, who's the lead prosecutor, who just sneak attacks this movie because I wasn't aware of her. I know she's been in a lot of TV stuff. She's been in Lie to Me. She's been in The Good Wife, Chicago Fire. I'm not as aware of her, but she is just spitfire in this. Great movie. Great TV movie. I've been recommending it left and right. Will, what did you think, though? Why'd you hate it?
No, I mean, I was the one that told you to watch it.
I mean,
I mean, even before I had a chance to see it, I was like, we should definitely check this out. You know, I was just intrigued because it was Friedkin's last film. And I wanted to see what he had this do for his final run. I mean, he like directed his way like his early 80s or mid 80s. And I think he had to get Guillermo del Toro to help get insurance for the film because the insurance wouldn't fund the film with him just directing. But by all accounts, Guillermo was pretty hands off and just, you know, let the master do his thing.
Friedkin was 87 when he died.
87, yeah. So he probably was like 85 or so, maybe 86 when this movie was being made. I mean, it's just like we were saying before, it's not super flashy. I think it is actually to the film's benefit that it's premiering on Showtime because, you know, it's all this one location, like you said. It's based on a play in some respects. So, you know, it's centralized to like this one location. It's not a super flashy location. But Friedkin really does get a lot out. You know, visually, it does really have a great sense of like establishing tone, pacing, suspense. And it's just really exciting, as you mentioned, to get this showcase for Jason Clark. I mean, this year, you know, if it's a court movie with him in it, you're going to get some good stuff because, you know, it's funny that this is sort of like the inverse of Oppenheimer, where it's like he's ostensibly the good guy, but you're rooting against him because, you know, Oppenheimer's the main character of that film. But in this movie, you know, from what we can gather, even from the beginning, he's like, you know, the bad guy, it's like the good guy here because, you know, like you're kind of rooting for him, but you also know, like, this may not be what you want it to be, but you're still like, oh, but like, he's convincing me, you know, like he's getting all these people to, you know, confess that maybe Jake Lacy is onto something. Maybe Kiefer Sutherland isn't on the level here. And I think what's fascinating to me about Kiefer Sutherland's performance, that it's the biggest, it's the most Brad performance. Like he's kind of doing like a Edward G. Robinson kind of like more mannerism heavy, kind of like maybe speaking out of his mouth a little bit. It's a little bit more performative, but it doesn't feel false to the film. You know, it's also just fairly centralized. It feels a lot more grounded, but there is a sense that like at any moment it could be a little too big, a little too hammy. But I think he just really brings out the sort of sorrow of the character. Whereas like we keep seeing the like sins of his laid out, but you also, when you see him, you sort of, you can despise him, but you also pity him because there is something innately sort of tragic and seemingly unwell about him. That really comes together really well, really beautifully in this performance. Were you about to say something?
I think that's where the play stuff kind of comes in. Because it is a very, you know, if anybody could criticize it, if you're the kind of person who doesn't like that translation from play to movie, it does fall into that. You know, it's got a little bit of that, like, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom kind of thing going on. And I don't ever mind that just because I think that, you know, it just, in that case, it just depends on the performances and how they play out. And I mean, Sutherland, he chews. Like he delivers what he needs to deliver here. And I think that, you know, I'm going to bring up Will's favorite thing, politics. And Donald Trump. But I, you know, I couldn't help but think about that. You know, we're in a situation, right, where Donald Trump's, you know, in court, you know, for a bunch of stuff. His sins are being like laid out, and you know, he's being like, you know, quote unquote persecuted for all of these things. And not to say that this is a one to one, but it's just kind of interesting to look at it in that context of like, you know, what does it take, right, for like a very powerful person in a privileged position to be held accountable for something if they should be held accountable for that sort of thing? And like, what is like the ethical line there, right? And what is the difficult job that prosecutors and defense attorneys both have in cases like this? That was one of my favorite things about this movie, is like it really does illustrate first of all, like how hard it is, right, to do this kind of thing, like to be a lawyer, you know, just in general. It really shows the rigors of that, I think, in full display. But then also it just kind of like gives you a good impression of like why it's not an enviable a position for everyone, and like why everybody has their own motives for what they're doing and how that all can play. And, you know, it shows how the justice system, you know, even in something like the military, is such a flawed process, because there is truly no way to know beyond a shadow of a doubt. But we have this like system in place that's like, you know, that works the way that it does, and it's all we have, right? Mm-hmm. So just in that sense, like I think it, even though it's a movie from the 50s or a play or a book from mm-hmm. the 50s, it's still, you know, it has that quality to it, you know, that I think we were talking about The Exorcist earlier. It just mm-hmm. it kind of just translates if you do it the right way. Now, and I think there could be a way to make this movie kind of an Exorcist believer sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It'd be very weird to see. But, you know, I think that Friedkin really had to work to like make this get there. And I'm so glad that they didn't just do like this is in the 50s. I think it's great that it's actually like by today's standards. It does lead to one or two kind of like weird things.
Yeah, I was going like, to say. Oh,
he's writing a book and he got a $10,000 advance. Right. Okay.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, and there's like a sort of clunky reference to 9/11 that feels very like
we gotta
take
something
out, put something in, sort of thing. You know, like you can hear like the keyboard deleting one thing, putting something else in.
Sure.
But I think what's also fascinating about this film for me, and I apologize if I speak out of turn because I'm by no means a Navy expert, but there's something about that that's so very clinically more. You know, scientific, because like in your Navy, you have to think very analytically. You have to like kind of plan things out. And the film presents itself as sort of like this classic way of, you know, like the process is very, driven by Lance Riddick being like very like ornate and being like, this is how we do things. And like, you know, we've never had this happen before. And so you have to kind of like respect those boundaries, and seeing Jason Clark kind of implode that, but also fall within those bounds in a very kind of sloppy but interesting way, creates a sort of innate drama that I think really plays out in such a fascinating way throughout the film, in the sense of like you see the sort of dynamics of this little politic come alive in such a very specific but very resounding way. It just makes for a really compelling drama, even when it can be, like we said, sort of televisual. I think Friedkin really finds interesting ways to shoot the scenes or the dynamics, or kind of use the camera to kind of turn perceptions or like allow us to see things in the performance that may have been overlooked by someone who isn't a veteran director like William Friedkin. Just really good stuff all around.
Yeah, you're 100% right, because it's so easy for a movie like this to feel stiff. Because how many different angles can you do? But you really, like, it's such a dynamic movie, and it takes such great advantage of that location. Every little detail is thought out, so you understand that space and why we're looking at that space in any particular time, and depending on the person that we're looking at. And to that note, I mean, yeah, it's a drama. It's also, this movie's also pretty funny. Like, I was laughing quite a bit at certain parts.
Yeah, me too.
Mainly with Lance Reddick, who I just think, may I remind everyone, like, I just really liked how, you really saw the court get away from him. And there was a funny bit that kind of reminded me of the classic John Mulaney gag, where he's like making fun of Law and Order, and he's like the court, the judge who accepts everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I'll allow it. But watch yourself, McCoy. Like, there was a point where I thought Lance Reddick was going to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything else to add. I do think that I don't love the ending. Not because I don't. I think that there's a nice subversion that happens. But there's also, like, this kind of feeling to it that feels a little bit, like, it feels a little both sides-y. It feels a little bit, like, defensive of, like, people who are bad. In a way of just like you don't have respect for, like, it was trying to do this like wishy-washy patriotism thing, which, like, I can get swept up into that. Sure, I'm an American. Well, I pay my taxes, but there was something that felt off about it to me. I don't know.
I mean, to me, I think that kind of gets into what we were talking about before, is like that scene is this where the Maggie and Mara Day feels a little awkward, just a sense of like that innate sort of patriotism.
We're post the war in Iraq. It's a harder thing to do when that movie was made post World War II.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I just think that sense of patriotism isn't as pronounced. And like, I don't think that scene really wants to change material. So it doesn't really reckon with like what that sort of patriotism would be in 2023. Or 2022.
This movie also has a very reactionary take on psychiatry that I do wonder if the original even has at all. But I mean, probably does, I guess. But like attitudes towards psychiatry, as we've discussed on Mad Men, have evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I'll play devil's advocate a little bit and say I think that's supposed to be more the mindset of the characters than I think the mindset of Friedkin or the material. But
I hear you. Yeah, I don't think it's an overt messaging thing. I just think it's like a kind of a weird carryover of like this movie does have that. It kind of dances with this idea of like, you're all quacks. Like you don't understand what it's like being on this ship. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit less of like, no, there's a science to this. And like the movie kind of waffles on it a little. And I don't envy what Friedkin had to kind of balance with that. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, it's just hard to translate certain things. And like, yeah, I guess it was something that gave me pause a few times.
But no, I mean, I get why it's like modernized. Like, I think it's cheaper and easier to make it now. Like, I think, you know, making a period appropriate, even something that's contained to two or three locations like this film.
Like the way people talk, right? It's like there's even more effort that has to be put into it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I just think I think it's really, like I said, just smart, sturdy. It's unflashy, but not without, you know, craft or skill. It just you can just tell Friedkin was a really good director. He knows how to make something like this that seems simple, really pop. And I think the fact that it looks so effortless is just a credit to him. Again, the fact that he could pull something like this off and being the talented director that he was. If you want something that's just good prime dad cinema, after you've seen Oppenheimer, I think this is a very easy recommend.
Well, is this a dad movie?
I'd say,
Can we give it the dad badge?
Sure, dad badge. I think it just feels like such a dad film. Like, in a sense, like, it's not really about dads, but it's just, like, dads would watch this and get really compelled. Like, the way they read, like, World War II novels.
In their seat.
Yeah. But no, I mean, it's a good year for lawyer movies, too, because we have Anatomy of a Fall coming out, in addition to this and Oppenheimer. So, I'm excited for that one. I'm excited for people to see this movie.
And I'm excited to call it a week.
Sure.
We'll be back next week. I think Will has already pitched us talking about the T-Swift documentary.
I mean, we have to, I guess, right? I'm not even that big of a Taylor Swift fan, but like,
well, you know, I mean,
it's the movie.
There's Dix the Musical. I'm going to be seeing Killers of the Flower Moon tomorrow. I'm not sure when you're going to be able to see that. Yeah, you're doing the thing. Yeah. There, you're like, good for you, John. Mm-hmm. We could also do a late review of Dumb Money if we find the time. There are a couple options, but as usual, hit us up either in the Discord or email us if you have any suggestions too. We'd love to hear it. And from the internet, California, I am John Negroni.
And from the internet, Pennsylvania, I'm Will Ashton. Recess. Court is dismissed.
Handle the truth.
Yeah.
Bye.
In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.
See you next time.